Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner Arthur Anderson versus Perry Equipment.
May I please report, Mr. Chairman, that the argument of petitioner has been filed.
May I please report, good morning. My name is Ben Taylor. I'm here today with Tom Godbold from our firm, and we're representing the petitioner Arthur Anderson on behalf of our client. We want to say we appreciate the opportunity to talk about our case this morning with the court. This is a suit alleging accounting, malpractice, and fraud. All the issues were hotly disputed in the trial court, but we're, of course, raising only legal challenges at the Supreme Court level. Therefore, our factual recitation is going to be brief and in the light most favorable to the respondent, Perry Equipment Corporation. But we will point out a couple of key points that I think are undisputed that we have to rely on and do rely on. In August of 1985, Perry Equipment Corporation purchased 100% of the outstanding capital stock of Maloney Pipeline Systems.
Mr. Taylor, let me ask you this. I'm sure we're all familiar with the facts, and if not, your recitation here I'm sure wouldn't help us. But isn't there, you're asking the court to reverse and render, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Isn't there something kind of inherently wrong about us reversing and rendering when, in fact, we're dealing with a party that you are representing who is an admitted, confessed, and found liable fraud feeser? In other words, you're asking for us to rule automatically in your favor even though you are a fraud feeser.
Well, Your Honor, we are not a fraud feeser on this record. We have not been subjected to a judgment under a theory of fraud. If we had been subjected to a judgment under a theory of fraud, we would have challenged that on no evidence grounds and on charge error grounds. But PECO elected to recover only under the DTPA, and because of the standards of review, we decided to limit our challenge to the challenge that PECO is not a consumer. We have not been convicted of fraud, and the finding of fraud is not estoppel or anything. It wasn't essential to this judgment. It doesn't have anything to do with this judgment.
All right. Second question. Aren't most of your concerns pretty much taken care of by the amendments to the DTPA? In other words, any type of impact that a decision in this case would have would be pretty much limited to this particular case. It wouldn't have much of an impact for the future of Texas jurisprudence because the new DTPA, if I understand it correctly, and I'm not going to be on record as committing to this position, but I think the new DTPA pretty much would eliminate this type of cause of action against accounting firms, would it not?
Your Honor, that's an argument that PECO and the amicus have gotten into.
I'm asking for your opinion.
In my opinion, this case does have significant impact.
No, I'm asking for your opinion about the impact that the new DTPA would have on claims against accounting firms for providing opinions and judgments.
I think the new act would strike PECO's claim, but on a different ground, because as PECO puts it, and I'm not going to go on the record as conceding to this, but as PECO puts it, accountants now have a special interest exception to the DTPA. But that's not the basis of our challenge that we provided judgment or advice, which we did, to our client and not to PECO. The basis of our challenge is consumer status.
And with regard to consumer status, isn't there testimony provided by someone from Arthur Anderson to the legislature that said, that expressed a concern about this very type of cause of action, which could be either implied or expressly stated by someone from Arthur Anderson, that this cause of action did exist with regard to consumer status?
I'm not knowledgeable about the testimony that was given to the legislature, and that's not in our record.
What I'm talking about is what was provided in the briefs of PECO.
PECO does assert that, and I have not verified whether Arthur Anderson gave testimony on that kind of issue. If someone from Arthur Anderson had given that kind of testimony, the problem that's being complained about, the provision of judgment or advice, is certainly an important problem, but it is not the problem we've raised. We've raised the problem that this court has recognized as a problem since Riverside National Bank versus Lewis, more recently in the Transport Insurance versus Faircloth, and just 12 days ago in the Amstad versus U.S. Brass case. We're talking about consumer status.
Okay, but Faircloth doesn't apply here because it's clear that Faircloth was not an intended third-party beneficiary. You would agree with that, right?
I would not agree with that.
You think Faircloth was an intended third-party beneficiary?
She's certainly a statutory beneficiary of liability insurance.
In what regard?
Well, I'm not sure I can cite the case, but I think Dairyland...
No, she wasn't a beneficiary to the insurance contract.
Dairyland County Mutual versus Childress, this isn't cited in the briefs, but I think that case holds back in the early 70s that injured third parties are intended beneficiaries of required liability insurance coverage.
She was not an injured third party.
My understanding of the case, she was, Your Honor. The contract in that case was between Allied Van Lines and Transport Insurance Company. She was an injured third party, she said. She said that her mother was killed in the accident.
But it wasn't her mother. That was the key. It was not her mother.
Well, this court didn't hold that. Judge Gonzales wrote in the opinion that the court wouldn't hold that as a matter of law and that the case couldn't be rendered on that point. Now, you're assuming that as a fact, and maybe that's right, but this court sure wouldn't hold that. If we are going to move on to consumer status, and I'm pleased to do so.
I'd like, on that point, you rely on Penn versus Dean Witter.
Yes, ma'am.
What did you do in the trial court, though, to preserve your consumer status point? Can you be specific with that?
Yes, I can. If you look in our application at point of error 4.1, we have specific references where this was raised. It was raised in special exceptions to the pleadings, asserting that that PICO was not a consumer. It was raised in a pretrial motion for summary judgment that was denied. It was raised in objections to the jury charge that asserted that PICO was not a consumer. It was raised in a motion to disregard jury findings and for take nothing judgment NOV, and it was raised in a motion to modify correct report.
What about the specific point that since this is a stock transaction, sale of stock, that your service should not be covered? Did you raise that in the trial court specifically?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. We had a huge fight in the trial court about the case law, and I'm not trying to ignore this side of the court. But we had a huge fight in the case law about the older cases like Kennedy versus Sale and Melody Home Manufacturing versus Barnes, which extended consumer status very liberally. And Perry continued to try to argue that services were provided and they indirectly benefited from these services, and consequently, under case law like Melody Home versus Barnes and Kennedy versus Sale, they should be treated as a beneficiary of the accounting services that Arthur Anderson provided its client. We came back and distinguished all of those cases, saying they don't apply. In each of those cases, the plaintiff had a transaction in goods or services. In Melody Home, it was a mobile home and related services. Flinikin, it was purchase of a house. Knight versus International Harvester, it was a purchase of a truck. So we were all over the point that Perry was seeking to acquire stock, which is not a good and it's not a service. So there's no question that this was before the trial court was ruled on adversely by the trial court.
But they're not complaining here about the stock they acquired. What they're complaining about is the accounting services that they acquired from Arthur Anderson.
That's the way they have pleaded the case, and you're right that is what they have pleaded in their complaint. I'll make 2 points in response to that. First off, we dispute that the accounting service is the basis of their complaint. We say that the basis of their complaint is the failed transaction. And if we're not right about this as a matter of law, we have a tendered jury question, and we've cited Exxon versus Perez and some other cases that say you can't deny someone jury submission of something that's at least disputed in the evidence. But on the matter of law challenge, we have two cases. Justice Owen brought out the Hand versus Dean Witter case. I think that is probably the strongest case we have in our favor, considering the purchase of intangibles, that if services that are incident to the purchase of an intangible are truly incidental to the purchase of an intangible, those services cannot qualify to make the purchaser of.
Is this incidental, though? In other words, if they had not received the services from Arthur Anderson, isn't it true that they would not have even gone through with the transaction? So it's not incidental, it's fundamental.
At the risk of quibbling, I'll dispute that they received the services of Arthur Anderson, but I will concede that there is evidence that the audit report had to be provided to Mr. Hartman, who was with the seller, and Arthur Anderson did have knowledge, according to some evidence, that the report was going to be provided to Perry before Perry went through. It was a condition of sale, and I do concede that.
Is there a difference between accounting services and auditing services?
I'm not an accountant, but I think that...
Well, I mean, I know there is a difference as an accountant, but to a third party.
I think that the two can be used interchangeably for these purposes. It may be outside the record that audit has a very specific meaning and that audit accounting
Perfect.
Services are broader in general. I think that what the record shows is that the audit is a situation in which the auditor performs tests of numbers supplied by management. The statements that we continue to hear have been prepared by Arthur Anderson. We're not prepared by Arthur Anderson. They were statements of Maloney Pipeline System Inc. management. Those statements were audited by Arthur Anderson's people. Arthur Anderson performs whatever tests Arthur Anderson determines to be necessary. It's more of a sampling basis, and then later issues an opinion letter. The opinion letter is all that Arthur Anderson prepares. That would be one of the challenges to the fraud claim if that ever were the basis of a judgment. But it's not Arthur Anderson's financial statements. The auditing services Arthur Anderson provides for its client are to test the numbers that management supplies and then to state an opinion whether those numbers do or do not appear fairly to represent financial condition.
And those were merely incidental services, you well, say?
I say they are incidental because...
Even though it's a condition of the transaction?
I say yes, and if you disagree with me on that, let me make a pitch at a higher plane for why we still win if you go against us on that. What is Perry's objective in this transaction? There is not a shred of evidence in the record that Perry cared a whit about Arthur Anderson. It certainly didn't pay us any fees. Didn't care a whit about Arthur Anderson or its services, except as a requirement of Perry's due diligence to decide whether it wants to buy what? 100% of a huge company so that it can compete with companies like Daniel Industries in Houston. And I think it's great that Perry wants to become a huge corporation supplying metering systems to the oil and gas world, and that's entrepreneurial spirit. The record is that they're an entrepreneurial company. But what their objective is the purchase of an intangible.
But if we were to go along with that reasoning, that would mean, in essence, that no consumer could ever bring a DTPA cause of action against an accounting firm because the accounting services are never the be-all, end-all objective. They are a means to achieving an end by a consumer, to use those accounting services to make an evaluation on some other project. And I think that the be-all, end-all of eliminating this type of cause of action against accounting firms was taken care of by the legislature during this past term.
Well, I think the court's order granting writ negatives the suggestion you're making that there's not still an important issue.
Well, let's go to some of the other issues in the case. So there's a lot of them, and specifically what you put up here on the damages. The argument, as I understand it, from opposing counsel is that they don't have to fall into either one of the bank's objectives because they were suing only for consequential damages. I mean, that's at least one argument they made. And that the evidence and the jury findings will establish that.
Well, you know what they call that in the TXO case? It's an after-the-fact rationalization. This is a case...
Well, that's what most appellate lawyers.
Well, it's not something we presented after the fact. It's something that we presented during the informal charge conferences. I read out loud to them what our objection was going to be. I told them that we're going to contend that the measure of damages is either out of pocket or benefit of the bargain. This is a company that purchased stock. There is not a single case that has been cited to court in the stock purchase context or in any purchase context where someone was able just to sort of ignore their burden of proving there's a difference in value between what the plaintiff parted with and what the plaintiff received. That difference has to be calculated as of the date of sale. And if that difference is not proved, they haven't proved damages.
Do you concede under the DTPA that anyone could ever get consequential damages only as a sole and entire measure of their damages?
I think that's what happened in Bynum, yes. I think that we have some very unremarkable statements that are made in the concurring opinion in the W.O. Bankston case. Justice Mosley was moved by the Longley and Maxwell people, and I think, Judge Phillips, you joined them, that made a very unremarkable statement, started off by saying that the out-of-pocket or benefit of bargain measure was proper in this case, and both of you concurred in the judgment. But you wanted to make the point that other reasonable and related expenditures could be proved in other cases. And so there was no dispute that this used car buyer had to prove his damages because he bought a car and had to prove it was worth less than what was represented or worth less than what he paid. But the consequential damages issue is an issue that has to be submitted separately. And in this case, consequential damages were submitted separately.
Doesn't the Bankston analysis not work in cases like this? Because under the Bankson analysis, you have to consider the value of the good on the date that it was received. And in Bankson, of course, it dealt with a car. And with a car with similar types of consumer goods, the value of that good declines with each passing day. In a case where you're buying a company or something like that, the anticipation, of course, is that the value of the company is not going to be declining, but instead increasing. So it seems as though if you apply the Bankson analysis to the purchase of a good that increases in value, as opposed to decreases in value over time, or at least is supposed to increase in value, that would result in a situation where the consumer could never prove any damages.
If I answer this question, could I still have a few minutes for rebuttal?
Well, you'll have five at the end. This is our time now, not yours.
Your Honor, back in 1987, they had a black market day. Stocks fell, Texaco filed for bankruptcy. If the sale had been 1 million shares of Texaco stock, and then 2 years later, Texaco went into bankruptcy, sure, the value is going to go down, but there are other factors that contribute to that. It's our position that at a minimum, you have to have a proper consequential damages question, a question that asks about direct causal relationship, so that you actually have loss causation in addition merely to transaction causation. But the measure of damages that we're asserting that this court set out in W.O. Bankson and reaffirmed just 2 years ago in Spencer in the opinion on rehearing is that when you have a purchase, you have to prove the difference in value at the time. Otherwise, the damages being recovered, as in this case, and Kavanaugh interest on top, are totally divorced from the actual fair causal responsibility that can be attributed to the defendant. And so we think that the measure of damages law has to be applied and has to be applied at the time of sale.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please record Mr. Michael Cash and Mr. Christopher Allen to present arguments for the respondent. Mr. Cash will open the first 15 minutes.
May it please the court. I will not rehash the facts. It's been pointed out the court is aware of the facts, but suffice it to say this audit was so poor that a jury found it to be negligent, fraudulent, and deceptive. The question which must be asked is PICO a consumer under the Act? Arthur Andersen does not argue about the quality of its audit here, but asks for an escape from its liability. To be a consumer, the legislature set forth the requirements. Arthur Andersen asks you to blur the distinction between the court and the legislature and between two separate and distinct transactions. The audit was sequentially first. It was a requirement before there could ever be a stock purchase. The testimony is unrebutted that if Dunman Perry and Perry Equipment Company saw an audit which showed a losing company, they would walk away, go back to Mineral Wells, and there would be no stock sale. Arthur Andersen has repeatedly referred to their duty to their client. However, they state in testimony, and I have handed out on consumer a red pamphlet on several of the issues. Under tab one, Mr. Vera, Arthur Andersen's partner in charge of the audit, testified himself that he knew it was a condition of the sale, that the audited financials were to be supplied through Mr. Hartman to Mr. Perry. But it goes further. Counsel mentioned U.S. Brass. Just according to U.S. Brass, one of the important distinctions was that the representations which were sued upon were not made directly to the consumer. And that's an important distinction in this case. In this case, it is undisputed that Perry Equipment Corporation personnel not only received the misrepresentations contained in the audited financials, which include a statement that it was done in accordance with generally accepted auditing standards, but also that they met with Arthur Andersen accountants during the course of the audit. Perry sat down with Arthur Andersen and had it explained to them what was going on, was shown lead schedules, was shown work papers. So very much representations and misrepresentations were made directly to this consumer. Certainly, PICO sought and acquired accounting services, and it is those services which form the basis of their complaint in the trial court. There are volumes of testimony discussing how poor the audit was. There is nothing in the record complaining of the value of the stock, but rather the advice given to us regarding the health of the company to allow us to make a decision to go forward.
Can you explain on the damage issue, moving to a little different subject, whether you call this consequential damages or actual damages, direct damages, whatever you call it, how can Perry sue for and obtain a judgment for the entire purchase price and at the same time retain any residual value of the stock without some duplication of recovery?
That is exactly the point, Justice Corman. There is no residual value of the stock, and in that I mean it was undisputed, and in fact the testimony was from Mr. Perry himself. If you'll look at tab 4, under questioning from Arthur Anderson's counsel, I want to explore with you, Mr. Perry, some of these damages. The $4,088,000 went to Ramtech, correct? Yes, sir. That is an investment that PICO made to acquire Maloney? Yes, sir. And that was a loss. Wrote that off? Yes, sir. That was the purchase price. When you write something off like banks write off a loan, that means they can't collect it. You just realize nothing from it. Right? That's right. That is uncontroverted.
What was realized out of the Chapter 7 liquidation?
It was liquidated and there was no profit back to PICO.
I realized no profit back to PICO, but did any creditors receive any money?
Yes, certain creditors were paid of Maloney, creditors that existed prior to us purchasing the company.
Are we talking about things that are in the record?
I believe that it is in the record that there was a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, it was liquidation, and Mr. Perry testified that PICO received nothing back, that the liquidation was to pay the creditors, there were settlements with the Unsecured Creditors Committee. Basically, PICO put money into the company, never took money out.
But PICO was stockholder?
Yes, they were 100% stockholder once they purchased the company.
And aren't stockholders last in fraud in bankruptcy?
Absolutely, and well should be. And again, that's exactly the point. They got nothing. And what I think is essential here is to look at the element.
Well, on the other side of the coin, though, would the bankruptcy records show that the trustee received some value from the sale of the assets of the loan time?
I don't believe so. I believe it's still in Chapter 7. I don't believe there were, per se.
You just said that certain creditors were paid.
I believe out of whatever cash or operating capital there may have been, and there may have been, and it is not in the record, a sale of certain assets. But the point being, it is PICO's damage, not Maloney's damage. Those were Maloney assets that were paid. It is what did PICO receive? And there has to be that distinction between the two entities. The fact that Maloney may have been able to pay some of its creditors does not affect what PICO received. What PICO received was nothing. PICO ended up getting nothing. That is the testimony. It was completely written off. And not only did they receive nothing, they paid money in.
But the write-off is more than a year after the transaction closed.
Yes, ma'am. And as Mr. Perry testified, it was a slippery slope. As soon as they got in, literally over that year, they found that there were millions of dollars in expenses on contracts that, according to Arthur Anderson in their audit, were 100% complete. And that's exactly why Bankston doesn't apply in a situation like this. There is no way to know on the date you purchase it that these expenses will keep coming in when you've been told by the auditors that these contracts are done. All of the profit has been
realized. But you can go back after the fact and reconstruct what the value actually was as of the day of the closing transaction.
Well, Exhibit 69 in the record, and you mentioned in the last last argument under the no evidence standard, it's Exhibit 69, which was the unaudited financial statement approximately 8 days after this sale at the end of August, shows that the company had negative shareholder equity, which is a negative net worth, which is certainly some evidence of a zero value.
Who provided that?
Who provided that evidence?
It was not. No. Who provided that unaudited statement?
An internal Maloney unaudited statement that came up after the fact.
So are you saying that, and that was 8 days after the sale, but there is no evidence indicating what the value of the company was on the date of the sale?
No, there is no evidence of exactly what the evidence was on the date it was sold.
Let's just assume that the company was worth something on the day that it was sold to you. Doesn't it seem as though Arthur Anderson should get some type of credit for that?
No, and the reason it shouldn't is because we do not examine the damages they caused as of the date of the sale. What we have to examine is the entire structure of the damages. What happened in this case is Arthur Anderson was a it was basically a traffic policeman at a fork in the road. If they showed a profit of the company, we would go down the road to a purchase. If they showed a loss, we would go back to Mineral Wells. Once they pointed us down the road to purchasing the company, anything we lost and parted with as a result of making that decision based upon a faulty audit should be recoverable.
Like lost profits?
Lost profits would have been. We did not plead from that because we plead for that because we felt them to be too speculative at the time. So we did not ask for lost profits. We tried to submit a conservative charge.
But you could.
We could have recovered lost profits as an element of consequential damages. And in fact, Wu, which is a Waco Court of Appeals case, was the first case to look at actual damages under the DTPA, and then Attorney General John Hill, who just spoke here, filed an amicus brief stating that do not be held to the strict out-of-pocket or benefit of the bargain because that's not what the Act is designed to do. The Waco Court of Appeals agreed and gave Mrs. Wu back her entire purchase price.
Well, let me ask you this. In this case, if you felt in retrospect, at the time you were going to trial, that the company that you purchased was worth nothing on the day that you purchased it, or was worth nothing 8 days after the day you purchased it, why didn't you put evidence on that, and why didn't you obtain a jury issue and jury finding on that point?
We believe that under Henry S. Miller v. Bynum and under the Wu case and under the Texas pattern jury charges and the DTPA that the more proper measure of damages at the time would have been exactly what we've pled for, lost purchase price plus other lost expenses. One of the distinctions here is Arthur Anderson is not in the role of seller as Bankston Nissan was, where they said this is worth a certain price and it ended up being worth less than they said. They are in a separate role where we went to them and said, is this company making a profit? We're not asking you to tell us what the price is. So there is no difference in what they represented the value to be and what we received. Rather, we felt the more proper measure of damages because of the nature of their wrong was you told us it's making a profit. That was the linchpin to us moving forward. Therefore, we are entitled to recover everything that we would not have otherwise spent. We felt that the concurrence in Bynum, joined in by four of the justices sitting today, was right on point, that it was consequential damages, and that certainly we would need to plead and prove those. In fact, if you'll look at tab 3, we cite to the record each element of consequential damages we pled, where we pled it, each consequential element of consequential damage awarded by the jury, and where the proof is supporting that. This is absolutely a case where the pronouncement in Henry S. Miller v. Bynum is correct. We have taken the liberty of adding in the parties in this case and leaving the language of Bynum, and basically it is Arthur Anderson's point that the only two measures of damage are out of the pocket of benefit of the bargain, and there's no evidence to support either one of those. If they are wrong, and there are other measures, as this court said in Bynum and Kish versus Van O, then their point must fail.
If the acquired company had not gone into liquidation for 5 years, would you still have the same measure of damages?
The jury would have to decide that. What was submitted, they say there was no causation issue. Actually, the consequential damage submission was conditionally submitted upon a finding of liability, and then stated, please state below what elements of damage you find were caused by the activity, and they enumerated questions.
So if it was tenuous enough, you say the jury could find that it did not result from misconduct.
Believe me, just heck, they did not fill in all the numbers we asked them to fill in, so they certainly took that within their bailiwick.
And if you were fearful that that was the case, you might submit a difference in value if they had the sale measure instead.
If we didn't feel we had the causal connection, we certainly would have had to go a different way.
Let's suppose that there had been disputed evidence that you made $2 million out of this company in the 9 months before it went into liquidation. You said you made nothing. They said you made $2 million. Would question 15 still fairly submit this case? And you would say the jury's answer here was a finding against their approval?
I think what would have had to happen, if there had been any evidence that we made any type of profit, then they would have properly said there is no evidence to support a submission that they lost the entire purchase price, and Judge Stone would have been correct to say, you're right, there is no evidence to submit a full purchase price evaluation.
So your issue is only valid if there's a complete absence of testimony in the record
that you pulled any money out of the company you acquired?
We believe if there had been evidence in the record showing that we received profits back, then we would not have been in as good a position on our issue. It is uncontroverted, however, and uncontested that there is no such evidence in this case. Mr. Allen will discuss the attorney's fees issue unless there are any other questions about the purchase price or consumer issue.
I have one question that you may be the person to answer this, and I meant to ask this of Mr. Taylor also, and hopefully he'll have a chance to answer it later. I noticed that there was a jury finding on the fraud issue.
Yes.
If this court were to rule against PICO on the DTPA cause of action, what would happen with regard to the jury verdict on that fraud issue?
We believe that the proper tack for this court to take in any instance, if it were to rule against PICO, would be to remand the case for further action upon the jury verdict. We have the right to select which judgment, which jury answers to take, but if this court now holds for some reason, either that we are not a consumer or that for some matter of law that was an inappropriate judgment to take, I don't believe it vitiates the other jury issues and would, should result in a render of a take-nothing judgment. I believe that the trial court should take further action based upon the jury answers and upon the direction of this court. However, under the law as it currently sits, certainly the DTPA issues, PICO is more than qualified as a consumer, as an intended third-party beneficiary, and the measure of damages which was submitted directly followed the Court of Appeals in Wu and this court in Henry S. Miller v. Bynum. One of the reasons we disagree with Bankston is because consequential damages were not an issue in Bankston, and Chief Justice Phillips, you pointed out in your concurrence that let's not get sidetracked on this being the exclusive measure of damages. We took that very seriously in drafting our charge.
May it please the court. The DTPA statute is the guideline for this court to use in determining whether or not attorney fees should be awarded under it to a prevailing consumer. The Act clearly provides that it shall provide for the recovery of attorney's fees reasonable and necessary to a prevailing consumer.
And is there evidence in the record showing testimony on your behalf that a contingency fee, attorney fee, was necessary?
Your Honor, there isn't, in a sense. What we had was our expert, Bob Hall, a 35-year-plus attorney in Houston, a named partner with Woodard Hall and Crim, who testified without objection that the attorney's fees was reasonable, and that was not objected to. In essence, Anderson's argument on that point is a no-evidence argument. They're saying there is no evidence. What they overlook is the fact that the jury concluded that the attorney's fees incurred by PICO were for necessary services. That was included in special issue number 20, which dealt with attorney's fees. They had to find that they were necessary. Since it's a no-evidence point, the standard of review is that this court must accept all the testimony and reasonable inferences therefrom that tend to support the jury finding and disregard any evidence to the contrary. A most reasonable inference from Mr. Hall's testimony is that he is aware of what the Texas Disciplinary Rules of Professional Conduct provide with regard to what is a reasonable attorney's fees. And what it provides in Rule 1.04, it states that factors that may be considered in determining the reasonableness of a fee include, but not to the exclusion of other relevant factors, the following. And the first one is the time and labor required. In other words, the time and labor that's necessary, the novelty and difficulty of the questions involved, and the skill requisite to perform the legal services properly. The skill requisite, another word for necessary. Necessary is subsumed in his testimony that it was reasonable. The issue itself presented to the jury was what would be a reasonable fee for the necessary services incurred by Perry in prosecuting the lawsuit. So we think the evidence is certainly there, both indirectly and directly, and the inference can be properly drawn.
But wasn't the question stated in a percentage?
The jury was presented on three different grounds. They could find an hourly, percentage of recovery, and a hybrid.
you took the percentage.
Yes, sir, we did, which we were able to do and afforded to do under the DTPA to maximize the recovery for Fair Equipment Company. What's interesting about what the jury did, which I think ties into this court's unanimous ruling in the GMAC case versus Blowhead 4 or 5 weeks ago, which this unanimous court found that a reasonable attorney's fee could be a contingent fee, which that case was brought as a DTPA action, in fact. But what Judge Cornyn said in that opinion was that it's necessary, when you're looking at a contingent fee, to perhaps measure it against an hourly or lodestar fee to make sure, to ensure that it would not be excessive, grossly excessive. That's precisely what the jury did in this case.
It's interesting to me that you made a tripartite submission on attorney's fees, looking ahead, I guess, to possible
absolutely
uncertainties in the law, but yes, you felt, not the part of the case you're arguing, but you felt so sure about your measure of damages in light of all this back and forth among the court that you just went with one submission when you could have gone with alternate submissions on your principal damages.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, what we had here was we gave the jury as much latitude as they possibly could to find out what they thought.
You could have given them a little more on the damage question.
Well, I suppose we could have, Your Honor, if indeed we were going under either out-of-pocket or benefit of the bargain. We chose simply not to. Based on Wu and Bynum, we felt like that
but
was all been in.
But you
would
have gotten the same amount
yes.
under either of those.
That is correct, Your Honor.
What if there were testimony and a jury finding that 90% would be fair?
Your Honor, if that's what I think the reasonableness of a jury of a attorney's fee is a fact question for the jury. We may all differ as to whether we would think that would be fair and reasonable, but if that's what the testimony presented, that's what the evidence was there, the jury felt that would be appropriate. I think it would be inappropriate for an appellate court to substitute its decision, its judgment, for that of the jury. What they did was they actually, if you go back and look at their answer to the actual damages, the consequential damages in issue number 15, which is approximately $5 million, when you look at what they gave in their answer to the hourly, and the percentage of recovery in the hybrid, those numbers come out virtually identical.
Ordinarily, there might be some ethical problems with a contingent fee agreement that was that high.
I would submit that there would be, Your Honor.
But you say if the jury finds it, that would insulate it from those problems.
Well, that would be our position, Your Honor. I think that if it is a fact issue, it's up for the jury to decide. If there was compelling testimony, I suppose that's in the province of the jury. And. Your Honor, we would just simply ask this court right the wrong that's been done to Perry, that they affirm in all things the opinion below.
Any other questions? Thank you,
Mr. Taylor, do you take the position that a contingency fee is never appropriate recovery under the DTPA?
That's the point this court granted writ on in Parkway versus Woodruff, and I think that's for the court to decide. Southland Life Insurance.
What's your position?
It is unreasonable, and it is not necessary.
It's never appropriate
for the defendant to have to pay. We don't care what the plaintiff pays.
Well, that's what I'm talking about in terms of the judgment. Right. The judgment the plaintiff gets against the defendant, it can never be based on a contingency fee.
That's our position.
If there was testimony that in an average DTPA case, a plaintiff could not get an attorney on a straight hourly, or at least that this particular plaintiff in a particular case couldn't get an attorney on an hourly rate, would that make a difference?
I think that would make our position tougher to sell. And there are two or three pages of testimony by Mr. Hall. He never said anything like that. There's no suggestion that Perry couldn't have afforded to pay PECO's attorney's fees.
So it's a matter of evidence, not of being not authorized, not a question of it being authorized or unauthorized by the statute. It's a matter of evidence.
Well, I think y'all can decide it on that basis. We've asserted the more global challenge because this court ran writ on it in the Parkway case. And we'll also point out, Judge Cornyn, that in the Parkway case that you authored for the court, there's a footnote that reaffirms Callejo versus Brazos Electric Power Cooperative. They want you to infer that this is necessary, but there's no testimony or evidence that the contingent fee was necessary. Judge Phillips pointed out they submitted it three different ways, which is sort of proof that it's not necessary.
When's the first time you objected to the attorney's fees on this particular basis?
It was the objection to question number 20 in charge. The last page of the objections right below, right above Judge Stone's signature. On the consumer challenge, one thing, point I didn't get to make, and I wanted to read one sentence, just pointing from your opinion in OMSOD 12 days ago, And we say that applies retroactively. I've been on the losing side of retroactive cases, and we want this one applied retroactively. So on page 11, while our words have varied, the concept has been consistent. The defendant's deceptive trade act or practice is not actionable unless it was committed in connection with the plaintiff's transaction in goods or services. That was after going through a lot of this court's case law on what is a consumer status.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. If the transaction concerning goods and services was between Ramtech and Arthur Andersen, you can see that Ramtech obtained services from Arthur Andersen.
Yes.
And so if PICO is a third-party beneficiary of those services, in other words, if we apply Kennedy, then that pretty much cuts the legs out of your argument, does it not?
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think the court heard similar arguments in the Lewis and Lambert case. That is not the basis. There is language about the insurance benefits being purchased for the benefit of Mr. Kennedy, but what the court said was he was covered under the policy. There was a legal relationship between him. It's like Aranda. A workers' compensation employee has a legal relationship. It's first party. It is not someone who just incidentally benefits from service. That person doesn't acquire, and there's no finding and no conclusive evidence that they acquired service from Arthur Andersen. We would, at a minimum, be entitled to some sort of jury question on that, but I think as a matter of law, they don't meet it. There's certainly no transaction. PICO is the plaintiff, and under what this court said in Amstad, there's no transaction in goods or services, and that cuts the legs out of their consumer argument. That there is no proof whatsoever of what happened on the Chapter 7 liquidation. There are documents before you that show Maloney was a big company, and sure, it had lots of problems, but there's no proof of how that came out. We have heard about this testimony, this agreeing to how banks write off a loan and you can't collect anything from it, but that doesn't prove anything about the market value. This court has looked at cases about the market value of corporate stock. Writing something off a year after a purchase doesn't prove that it had zero market value a year before. There was plenty of evidence, and we cited it in our brief, and it was certainly disputed evidence, but there was evidence from which the jury could have found that the stock had substantial value, as much or more as the purchase price. And I'm not saying that it's all that believable of evidence, but we didn't even get a jury finding on this. Judge Phillips, you asked, does it fairly submit? The first part of that question doesn't have causation in it like the second part did. Part B, which is the line item list of things, it said as a result of Perry's ownership or acquisition and ownership of PICO. Part A doesn't say that. All it says is purchase price of MPSI. The only causation in that question is the resulting from language. In the Allbritton case, we've heard about some of the problems of legal causation. This case stretches it to the limit. It's just not there.
Mr. Taylor, what is your answer to the response that Bynum controls and says there are other measures because we have the DTPA other than benefit of the bargain or out-of-pocket?
I've got a lot of problems with the Bynum case, but I think we get around it under Justice Enoch's recent opinion for the court in the Haynes and Boone case. Footnote 4 in that case explains the holding of Bynum. Remember, that was tried by Judge Powell. There weren't any findings of fact by a jury. There wasn't anyone's right of trial by jury involved. Justice Enoch explained to the court that the evidence in that case established a, quote, direct causal relationship between the defendant's conduct and the damages suffered. In our case, all we've got is this vague resulting from language in the charge. There's not direct causal relationship, and I object to the charge. They weren't submitting any issue about direct causal relationship. So I think that's our best answer. We were denied our right to jury trial of direct causal relationship, assuming there is that issue raised that we caused the bankruptcy.
Well, but in the dollars that came out as the damages at another level of inquiry, you may be unhappy about the causation part, but they still come up with their claim that in addition to out-of-pocket and the other one, that you can get other damages, which, and they say in this case, is the purchase price.
This court has never so held in a case involving a jury trial. Judges presumably have some idea about what the measure of damages is in a stock purchase case. Bynum sets out a very...
Well, but we're talking about a DTPA recovery, which says that you can recover your actual damages. Their point is, we contend that in this case, actual damages is the loss of our entire purchase price. Your position is, no, you only got two measures, and you didn't prove either one of them, you're out. So how do you answer Bynum?
I answer that with the W.O. Banks and Nissan case. Under Bynum, if the majority opinion, rather than the four-judge concurring opinion, if the majority opinion in Bynum is the law for sale transaction as opposed to the lease transaction that was involved in that case, if the majority opinion is the law for every transaction which we dispute, it establishes only that if you can prove a direct causal relationship between what would ordinarily be consequential or special damages, you can recover them. But that wasn't proved here, and it wasn't submitted to the jury. And if they don't submit some sort of direct consequential language in the charge, they can't just ignore W.O. Banks and then their burden of proving the difference in value. And I appreciate the court's indulgence.
Any other questions? One last question. That is, again, let's just assume that we were to rule in favor of Arthur Anderson on the DTPA cause of action. Why then would we not remand the case to the trial court for implementation of the fraud verdict rendered by the jury?
Remand for what, Your Honor?
For implementation of the fraud verdict rendered by the jury.
Well, I think at that point we would have a reason and an opportunity to challenge the fraud verdict. The fraud verdict has never been a basis of a judgment. If the fraud were used to try to, we would have the measure of damages argument. PICO's never contended they get around our measure of damages argument on fraud. So if we win that, they lose on fraud. But just without trying to be exhaustive, if you look at the fraud submission, it was fraudulent misrepresentation or non-disclosure. And we objected to that because we don't have any relationship with them and we don't have a duty.
Since that's not an appeal here, what would have to happen if we were to rule in your favor on the DTPA claim would be to remand it to the trial court for implementation of the fraud verdict and that then let you all appeal that verdict. Wouldn't that be the proper course?
I don't think that would be permissible under 81B1. I think this court's duty is to reverse and render the judgment that the court below should have rendered. In theory, I suppose you could reverse and remand to the Court of Appeals for further proceedings. If you hold that this judgment can't stand under the DTPA, then PICO might make a different election. If PICO tried to elect a fraud recovery, I think under Rule 83 and 185, we would be entitled to show that those theories could not possibly support a judgment.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument and the second call.
All right.